Welcome to DC Specialcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics of the Bronze Age, which included such titles as the aptly named DC Special and Special Series, but also DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, Four-Star Superhero Spectacular, and others. If you've read any of these comics, you know they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at the time. Today I'm joined by Fire and Water All-Star, host of too many podcasts to name, and an avid romance comic reader and blogger, Siskoid. Hey Siskoid, welcome to DC Specialcast.
Thanks, Paul. I don't know how avid I am, you know? But I did do some work in romance comics.
Yeah, tell us about that. Tell us about how you got started. Inform those of our listeners who may not know.
People know the network, may know Oh Hot More Not. And the Hot Squad and I, before they were ever called the Hot Squad, were doing a Hot or Not for the Legion of Super Bloggers. Hot was one of the categories because Shag was a member. He would show hot pics of the Legionnaires, both male and female. So he was like equal opportunity. But we felt, well, we really need a female voice. So I got the girls together at an Indian food dinner and proposed the idea. And it was just like a text-based version of the podcast you can listen to today. And just Legion inspired. Okay, skip a year or so, or 6 months, or I don't know how long, but I want to get into podcasting. I'm already doing a bit of stuff with Shag. This is all pre-Fire and Water, but not pre-Fire and Water podcast per se. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing a few things with Shag, role-playing based, etc. And I decide, well, I need to launch a French language show for my improv community, long form interviews and so on. But I think that's kind of important in terms of history and keeping our history alive, our oral history. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to mess it up. So I said, oh, I'll start a crappy podcast so I can learn the ropes and learn how to edit and learn how to broadcast and, you know, like publish and all of that stuff. And still with Shag's help. Thank you, Shag. But the idea I had was, well, let's do a reverse of Hot or Not. And so I got three of my boys together and we decided to do just like, okay, girls talking about superheroes. It's funny. Let's do boys talking about romance comics, which was generally pitched at girls or young women. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of these are older comics. We can laugh about the sexual politics of those eras. We expanded to make it interesting for comic book readers of today. We had stuff like Spider-Man's Many Loves or stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm. So that show became, I mean, accidentally, sort of my audition for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So when FNW was started, I was asked to join based on the strength of that podcast.
Mm-hmm. That's where I would have first heard your voice, I would think, because I tried every one of them out at the time.
So it's not something I was reading beforehand, like romance comics, not really. You know, you start exploring it, start finding comics or collections that had interesting stories. And we laughed a lot because it was like a comedy troupe, much like the Hot Squad is. Right. And then when I was joined the Fire and Water Podcast Network, that's when we decided, well, everybody needs to like pitch new shows to keep this thing alive, not just our old shows combined together. You know, that's when we did the podcast version of the Hot Squad. Right. So the romance podcast, Lonely Hearts, isn't on anymore. Like the group fell apart, if you will. But Oh Hot More Not is still going on after, I don't know, 140 episodes or so.
Impressive.
But that was really my start of my interest in romance comics per se. So that's why I'm not necessarily an avid romance comics reader or podcaster or whatever. But it did provide, I think those episodes still stand up today.
Well, thanks. So in case you haven't figured out, listeners, we are doing a romance comic today. Yeah. I guess I forgot to mention that. Before we get started on that, I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Specialcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 40% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. So I was recently informed by Siskoid that InStockTrade does now ship to Canada. So what do you have for our listeners, Siskoid?
Well, my pick is Weird Love, That Is the Way I Like It, hardcover, volume 2. That's the one they have. There are several volumes of these hardcover collections of vintage public domain romance comics. And this is the only one available, which is why I picked it. But these were really my bread and butter on Lonely Hearts because you could be sure to get something non-generic to discuss or to turn into a romance comics theater piece. It was put out by IDW, of course, a variety of writers and artists from across different publishers, many unknown and uncredited, especially writers. Regular price, $29.99. In stock trades price, $19.99. You save 35%. They also have a damaged copy going for $14.99. Guess it, get it while you can. But these were like, there was a lot of fun in those. It's like they were like the weirdest possible, but sincerely written as romance comics. They were not written as weird pieces, except they were.
That's cool. Yeah, I took a look at that. I saw the link. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. A lot of those public domain comics are fun, like the PS Art books, or I bought a number of Guandanaland comics over the years. So they're fun to get. You get some unusual stories that you wouldn't read otherwise.
Right. And there's a lot of publishers that collapsed. You know, like Charlton had a bunch of romance comics. Yeah. And there's like older 40s, 50s ones that those companies don't publish anymore. So it's a nice collection.
I went a little more modern. I went with a modern romance tinged comics. It's called Barnstormers, The Ballad of Love and Murder, trade paperback, written by someone who's familiar to us as DC readers, Scott Snyder, with beautiful art by Tula Lute. It's 1927, the late days of the barnstorming era, when pilots competed with each other by performing deadlier and more wondrous feats. Huck E. Baron is an adventurer who lives his life traveling from town to town in his plane, entertaining folks, most of whom have never even seen a car, let alone a plane. His world changes when he meets Tilly, a young woman who shares his passion for aviation and adventure. They become a traveling act, delighting folks with their antics. Tilly even becomes Hawk's wing walker, climbing out on the wing of the plane mid-flight to perform death-defying acrobatics. When they learn they are suspected of a horrific crime, there's Scott Snyder for you, their journey becomes an even deadlier race against time. Along the way, they bond, confessing their secrets, and of course, begin a romance in this lush, character-driven series that explores the early days of aviation and the evolving relationship and romance between two young pilots. Trade paperback, full color, $24.99. In-stock trades has it for $16.24. You save 35%. I actually read this, I think when it came out, or maybe I got it on Hoopla or something. I don't remember buying the issues, but I have read it, and the art is gorgeous, and it's a pretty engaging story, so I do actually recommend this. All right, let's talk about Super DC Giant S21, entitled Love 1971. So we haven't had a Super DC Giant yet, so this is one of the earlier sort of precursor of DC Special. This one had a cover date of January, February 1971, and on sale November 25th of 1970. Had a cover price of 25 cents with 64 pages and was edited by Joe Orlando. Starting out with Wayne Special Investments, this comic is by far the rarest and most expensive we've covered yet on DC Special Cast. You know, there are no copies listed for sale on Hip Comic, where I have a store. And on eBay, there are only 4 active listings at the time of recording, one of which is graded, and therefore, of course, you can't read it. The CGC graded 8.5 is listed for $700. The other 3 are all priced between $150 and $220. And of the other copies that were sold on eBay recently, the lowest one sold for $75, which was pretty beat up. And some others at like a very good or a fine sold between $100 and $200. So the market for romance comics is unusual. There's not a ton of collectors, but the books themselves are rarer, especially in high grade, than the superhero comics because people didn't hang on to them. So it's not the most liquid market. You know, you get somebody who will come and grab them all like you talked about, or you know, they sit for a long time. You don't see them at shows very often. This was actually one of the last DC specials, you know, of all the different comics I count in my remit for the show, one of the last ones I procured to complete my set. Mine's about a very good to a fine, and I bought it probably 15 years ago at a show for about $70. Unfortunately, this issue is not on DC Universe Infinite. The first story is all new, but the others are reprints from older comics. I'll try to put plenty of pages in the gallery post. For historical context, this month, November of 1970, easily the most significant DC comic published this month was Superman number 233. That's the one where the iconic Neil Adams Superman bursting the kryptonite chains cover marked the beginning of a new era for Superman, for many, the start of the Bronze Age. But, you know, more interesting this month, I wanted to talk about the huge variation in genre. If you look at Mike's Amazing World, you'll find that this month, DC published the following number of comics. Superhero comics, 11. Romance comics, 6. Second number of genre. Humor comics, 3. Mystery horror, 2. War comics, 2. And then sci-fi, Western, crime, and Hot Wheels, one of each. For Marvel, I didn't see any super key comics published this month, but they also had an amazing variety. Besides their superhero fare, We got Millie the Model number 188. So think about that one for a minute. 188 issues of Millie the Model.
Started in the 40s, yeah.
Issues of Monsters on the Prowl, Our Love Story, Outlaw Kid, Rawhide Kid, Sergeant Fury, and Western Gunfighters. There were also tons of Charltons, Archie's Gold Key, and even an issue of Ronald McDonald that I never knew existed. So it was a very different business in November 1970 than the comic book industry today, which is almost exclusively superheroes and science fiction and horror. So, Siskoid, do you have any favorites you want to point out from this month?
Well, looking at this distribution, if there can only be one, let's say I can only get one, it would be Jimmy Olsen, the number 135. It's the third issue of Jack Kirby's run, and therefore the start of the Fourth World saga. But otherwise, we're kind of in the no man's land after the Silver Age ends and the Bronze Age has yet to really solidify. Kirby's left Marvel in shambles. And at DC, I do have some affection for those. I mean, in this era, Aquaman was great. Any war comic written by Robert Kanigher and at least have a cover by Jill Kubert, like Our Army at War and Our Fighting Forces here, that would go in my collection. Son of Tomahawk was pretty great, actually. That's here. And normally I'd throw in the Teen Titans, but number 31 isn't a Bob Haney issue, so no, not that one.
So thanks as always to our favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. Back to our comic, Love 1971. I'm really interested to hear what you have to say about the cover, Siskoid. So would you like to describe it for our listeners? It is a cover by someone named Charlie Armentano. Give us your thoughts, Siskoid.
Well, he covers the main story from the issue, more or less, as we'll discuss, called The Reckless Losers, which is about romance at a Formula One track. And aside from the blurbs, it could be, looking at it, the European poster for a movie like Grand Prix, which I still think is the best racing movie ever made. It's a little psychedelic. The colors are groovy. They're unnaturalistic. And it's like all the images are flowing into one another. There's a kissing couple, goes into the car, the checkered flag going into the crying girl's hair. I mean, it's pretty cool. How do you like it, Paul?
Oh, I love it. I think it's a striking cover. The colors are unusual. The subject matter.
Textures, yeah, the textures are weird.
I particularly like, you mentioned the checker flag going into the hair. You can tell what the story is going to be about, right? You see one girl kissing the race car driver, and you see the race car. That's where you get your action, and the other girl with two tears coming out of her eyes. I just think it sells the package pretty well. I said to myself when I saw this, and we decided to do this issue, and I was like, "Who the heck is Charlie Armentano?" So I looked him up on Mike's Amazing World, and he has one comic book credit, according to Mike's Amazing World, and this is it. So I researched it a bit more and I found out that Charlie is still an active graphic artist and that he has an awesome website with some of his work. It's charlesarmentanoart.com. So I'll put a link in the show notes for anybody who wants to check it out. And I would recommend you do. And I will say he's done an acrylic painting recreation of this cover, which is stunning and still available on the site. The painting measures 24 by 36 and was created 50 years after he drew this original cover, which I thought was cool.
It's acrylic painting, but it really looks like silk screen with those big blocks of even colors. Yeah, it's very cool.
Well, so how do I know that? Well, I went a step further and I actually contacted Charlie through the website, and he was gracious enough to call me back. We had a
Wow.
very nice chat. Yeah, and I found out some neat information about this cover in particular and his career in general. He told me he'd always been interested in art as a child and he studied art in college, where he became friends with Bob Larkin, who of course later became a famous comic book artist known for his cover paintings. As Charlie recalls, Bob knew somebody at DC, and one day they just showed up at the DC offices with their portfolios. This is what you did in the late 60s and 70s. You know, I think this is so cool. Charlie didn't recall who exactly he spoke to at DC, but I'm guessing it was Joe Orlando since he was the editor of this comic, right? And he took on a lot of those art related duties at DC. Joe liked his portfolio enough that he told Charlie, say, go create a cover based on the theme of love. That's all he gave him. That's all the instructions. And this cover was the result. He came up with the idea of the love triangle and the race car. Charlie also told me that he did the whole thing using markers, not traditional pencil and ink that's done for comics. He wasn't sure how DC did the color separation, but the result was this very unusual and I think stunning cover. I just think that's just a really cool story that he told me. And as we'll find out, as Siskoid mentioned, then they based the lead story on this image. That was really neat that Charlie told me all about that.
What's interesting is that he could have done anything. And if he'd done something more generic, then they might just have published, just old stories. But instead, because there's a car there, it's like, well, I guess we need to write a new story where there's a car.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just really neat. Charlie, I talked to him for a while, and he also told me that the original marker rendering sold at Heritage Auctions a few years ago for over $10,000, which I thought was really neat. He then surprised me when he told me he was asked to do another piece that's not listed on Mike's Amazing World that ended up as the back cover of DC 100-page Super Spectacular number 5, Love Stories, published in July of 1971. I will include a scan of that as well in the gallery. It is equally as stunning. That book is also expensive and hard to find, but DC did do a replica edition of that one in 2001, and that does also have the back cover. Yeah, I thought that was really cool. So I asked Charlie what he did after that. He told me he had a great career in commercial art, doing illustrations for agencies and other companies. When Adobe came along with their software, he learned to draw and create on a Mac. There's an animal poster on his website that he told me was the last commercial illustration he did using traditional art supplies. He now owns a graphic design studio that concentrates on direct marketing and web design. Like I said, I encourage you to go check out his website. Finally, a funny note, he was a model for Bob Larkin for one of his paintings that became the cover of Monsters of the Movies number 2. I will put a scan of that in the gallery as well. You get to see what Charlie looked like in 1974. So I was just thrilled that Charlie responded to my outreach and gave us some terrific information about his career and this amazing cover. So thanks, Charlie, for doing that.
Impressive research, Paul.
It's just, I just was hoping to get some contact, and he was, like I said, very gracious about it. So that was great. Of course, I will post the cover, the back cover to the 100-page spectacular by Charlie, plenty of other pages of this comic on the gallery page for DC Special Cast on fireandwaterpodcast.com. All right, so let's jump into that first story based on this awesome cover. It is called The Reckless Losers. It's a 9-pager. It is written and penciled by Rick Estrada and inked by Tony DiZuniga. It was the only news story created for this issue. Unfortunately, like I said, it's never been reprinted. So, Siskoid, would you like to summarize a story for everybody?
Sure. So wealthy and gorgeous red-haired Fleur McCalmon sponsors race car driver Space Smith in more ways than one. She exhorts him to win the Parnelli Grand Prix, and she will reward him with anything he wants. Meanwhile, Fleur's mechanic, Maria, looks on and wonders why Space can't see that Fleur is just using him. She thinks back to how they discovered Space and what a daredevil he was, nearly causing an accident. But Fleur saw talent in him, and now, a year later, he was a top race car driver. But a tear comes to Maria's eye. He barely even notices her. Maria knows that Fleur will just use him up and spit him out. Then one day, Space and Maria grab a burger for lunch and really talk. We find out that Maria learned how to be a mechanic from her father's garage in Puerto Rico. Although Maria and Space become closer, Fleur still has a hold on Space, which is the name of the character, you know. It's just a hold on Space. But neither woman could compete with Space's ambition. Space wins the Grand Prix, but at a cost. Space's aggressive driving led to another racer crashing and dying. While Fleur and Space celebrate the win, Maria realizes what kind of man Space really is. And we see what kind of woman Fleur is as well. At the victory dinner for the race, she announces she's retiring from race car sponsorship and taking up with professional boxing, sponsoring Joe Ricardo, her new beau. Space seemingly comes to his senses and later that night approaches Maria and tells her that he loves her and wants to marry her. But Maria refuses, telling him that he probably thinks he loves her, but not enough. His real love is the thrill of racing and his car. Maria tells Space that his real bride is death, and she doesn't want to be there at that wedding.
Awesome. So, what'd you think of this story?
It does feel like the more modern of all the stories because it's not a reprint. And at the end, surprisingly, Maria does the right thing. You know, it's like if you're reading this, especially as a modern reader, as a modern woman, perhaps, I don't think her motivations go far enough. Like she still hangs on to him. It's like she still loves him at the end, but there is a realization. It's not that he's going to marry death or that you're just like obsessed with racing. It's like he caused another guy's death because of his ambition, and he doesn't seem
Doesn't
to.
came to care, yeah.
No, there's no remorse to me. And there's other parts of this story where I'm questioning Space very much. And his intentions and attitudes. But she does the right thing. She doesn't end up with him. And sometimes you could read some of these romance stories, especially the earlier ones, and the lesson is like it's written by men and it's kind of teaching girls to accept their fate or to prioritize love and enter into toxic relationships. In some of those stories, it doesn't always end well. The lesson seems to be wrong. In this case, I think the lesson is correct, even if maybe I don't think Estrada goes far enough in his portrayal of Maria and what, you know, what she sees as a problem.
Yeah, I mean, Maria is a flawed
heroine,
protagonist, flawed heroine, but it is encouraging that at the end she says many times to the story, oh, doesn't he realize how Flora is taking advantage of him, isn't a good person, but it takes her longer to realize that neither is Space a very good person, right?
Right.
But she realizes that at the end, which is admirable. There's a lot of that in this book that we'll see of coming to realizations sometimes earlier than later.
Yeah, that's how you have to like to build it, right? What are these stories? There's not like a superhero story or even the other kinds of stories, like a Western. If there's a hero, they have to overcome something. In a romance story, you have to overcome your own feelings, I guess, is might be the thing. And we get a lot of the tropes that we should be expecting from romance comics here. It's a first person confidential, for example, that's very frequent. The stories will be told in the point of view of the heroine. So we get that. One thing that I always watch for is the red dress. We found that out quite early on Lonely Hearts, when a character suddenly, like a shy character, suddenly wears a red dress. It's a symbol. It's like Superman's cape. It's a symbol of their taking ownership of their own power and gaining agency in the story. So in this case, the car is red, you know, but she never does wear red.
Interesting.
Fleur wears red at one point, just in one panel, and Maria never goes further than pink. And I think that's appropriate. I don't, it's accidental, I'm sure, but it still feels appropriate to that scheme.
Very cool. A couple beats I want to talk about. The
sure.
beginning, we were at the race and Fleur is wishing him well. And then they flash back to how they met him. What do you think of this power move by Space to meet these two girls?
Yes, it's totally a power move. It's never addressed that it is a power move. Like, they never say that he did this on purpose. He's driving by their car in his motorcycle. He's being kind of a jerk as well. And then he ends up in an accident. But as soon as they run up to the accident, he grabs Fleur and kisses her. No consent. And she's fine with it, I guess, because, you know, they soon start to date. But it's not addressed, but it's like, okay, so he never, they don't see the accident.
No, I always assume he faked it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, they just don't say it. So it's like Maria never really figures that out.
Yeah.
Because she has to be hornswoggled as much as Fleur has to be. You know, it's like she falls in love with this guy for the thrill of thinking that she might be with this kind of guy. I think, you know, they're just like, it's not a very deep relationship.
Right.
But this is totally a power move. This guy's a jerk and a manipulator from the beginning.
Right. And then we get a scene I did like on page 4. Laura tells Space that no driver of mine is going to be dressed like that. And he's dressed in a fringe jacket and sort of old jeans.
A hippie.
A hippie. She gives him a card of a men's fashion store. And you want to describe his outfit when he comes back?
Well, white pants. It must be before Labor Day. And like this blue jacket, which may or may not be denim. It's got like the double. It's kind of what Two Gun Kid wears. You know, the kind of the breast with the two button stripes. And the scarf.
The scarf.
A very feminine pink scarf. For a racer, racers and scarves, right? He's got a flap in the wind. I'm sure it's better, but also it's like it shows me that Fleur is the worst. She wants to change her man. She wants to make him a success. And once she's done that, by the end, she changes to another man. So, yeah, you don't want to date her and you don't want to date him.
I love his line. Dig my kicky togs, Maria. That's awesome.
All of this hippie speak in late 60s. Well, not even late, you know, just 60s, 70s comics. I don't know if people actually spoke that way, but kind of crazy.
So I did like, we do get a hint that Maria has some sense of a head on her shoulders in the middle of the next page where he's got a couple of trophies and he's kissing his trophies. And Maria thinks to herself, he seems to love his cups more than he loves people.
Loves his cups more than he loves mine. And that's, because she does say, I'm not a trophy. Can you really spare the time? You know, when he asks her out.
Yeah.
And it's like he's asking her out, but it's because he's being ignored by the other girl.
Right.
It's like later when he says, it's you I love. It's like, nah, man, you just got dumped. I'm all that's left. You know, I'm the leftovers. So, yeah, she's a little smarter. She's portrayed as something of, I guess, a tomboy, you would say, because she's a mechanic. She was daddy's girl, and she learned what would be typically 1970 for sure, male skills, a male skill set. Maybe she's got like a better radar about these, or she's not very good at romance, so she can cut through the bull.
She's not above some typical sort of female antics from 1970 where she gets space to help her put the heavy battery into the car. Oh, space, this battery is so heavy. I thought that was funny. I thought that was mildly out of character for her, but
Maybe it just was
yeah,
heavy.
maybe it just was heavy. Maybe it just was.
At this point, she's getting really jealous of
Yeah.
Fleur because Fleur like jumps in anytime that she's talking to Space. Fleur jumps in,
Right.
basically, come in, you know, come in, see this, and she takes her away. So I think Fleur is very aware as well. You see her in the battery
Yeah.
panel; she's
Yeah.
in the background, really pissed off.
Yeah.
So there is a competition between the two of them that Fleur has already won, but still creates that rivalry.
Well, Fleur's not averse to making sure Maria knows who the boss is, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So then we get the scene where they have the race and the other driver of number three dies and Face is like, I won, baby, I won. And Fleur says, you were great. And Maria says, but Adams, the driver of number three, he was killed. And then we see Space's true colors. He's dead. It's his own fault. He didn't have to go into that curve with a crippled car. You pushed him, Space. I had to. He gave me no choice. And that's the last he wants to talk about it. I thought that was an interesting twist.
At that point, I thought, okay, the only way this can go and still be reasonable is that she's out of love with him.
Yeah.
And it kind of plays that way, even if the dialogue goes a little off of it. I felt like it played that way. If she's crying, it's because she's lost something, which is her idea of him. And when Fleur dumps him and he goes to her, I felt, yeah, no, she's no longer in love with you, dude.
Yep,
And
she's figured it out.
yeah, it's not quite how they phrase it, but I think that's really what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can allow for her having some residual emotions if she would,
Sure.
it's sad that it didn't work out the way that, she would have liked.
Yeah, I guess she lost a lot of time on this.
Yeah, really. So, we didn't talk about the art. Rick Estrada has done plenty of superhero work.
Yeah.
I thought the art in this story was really good. I mean, the women are very attractive. Space is made to look like, an attractive guy. They've got fashions and, I don't know. I thought the art in this was really good.
I mean, I've never been a big fan of Rick Estrada's art. I think he's Jim's, the panels are too small and the figures are often too small. And for superheroes, I felt like it's often very cramped. In this, I have the same basic opinion, but he does do some interesting things. Like whenever he puts a female face really close to camera, he goes in and then shades it. And you can tell he's a really good illustrator. But when anytime somebody gets a little far, things get a little more a stick figure. I mean, not quite, but
Yeah.
you know what I mean?
The panel where the car crashed, I didn't think looked very good, very realistic.
Dramatic, or yeah, like he didn't he do like Karate Kid or series like that in the mid 70s? And it's like it's always like, oh, there's action, but the action is kind of, I don't know, it always lacks a little something. So when he's just doing emotions and doing like shadows, and that works great. And he's got Tony DeZuniga, on inks here, I think that helps a lot on that side of things.
All right, let's go to our second story. It's called Live Without Love. It's a 13-pager by, we don't know who the
We
writer
don't know.
was.
Like I said, there's a lot of these comics were just uncredited. And because romance comics aren't necessarily in favor and it's not like something people seek out, nobody really does the research or, in the same way that for even golden age comics, like superhero comics, or we're going to try to find a credit. That's not the case here,
No, a
no.
lot of those people went back to the pay records and stuff to figure it
Yeah.
out. My go-to is Mike's Amazing World. When it says unknown, I do once in a while go on to the Grand Comics database at
Right.
comics.org, and they didn't have any writer credit for this story either. And it could have been the artist, J. Scott Pike. Pike is better known. I said, I know that name, and I looked up, and of course, he drew the Dolphin story in Showcase. So he was the creator
Okay.
of Dolphin. And
Nice.
so I thought that was a pretty cool little connection. This story was reprinted from Young Romance, number 140 from 1966. It goes like this. Gail and Wanda were enjoying a nice day on the beach when they met Richie. They both developed feelings for him over time, but it was clear that he preferred Gail, and they began going steady. After a while, Wanda asked her friend what she would do if Richie proposed. Mysteriously, Gail said she didn't know. But Wanda implored her that she better make up her mind since it was not fair to Richie. And if she didn't want him, Wanda would take him. Of course, Richie did propose to Gail, but she refused, telling him that she can't. Confused, Richie went to Wanda to ask what was going on. And Wanda summoned Gail over to her house, saying that if Gail wouldn't tell him, she would. Turns out Gail had promised another man, Peter, that she would wait for him until he came out of the service. But he had been reported missing in action for over 3 years. She told Richie that she loved him now, but felt terrible about breaking her promise, even if Peter was never coming home. Wanda and Richie implored her to live in the present, and Gail and Richie eventually were indeed married. 2 years later, they were at a drive-in restaurant when Gail saw Peter with another woman, his wife. He had fallen in love with someone else when he returned from the service, but had been embarrassed about contacting Gail. So a happy ending for all. So Cisco, what do you think about this story?
Well, I mean, at first I thought, what is this? This is really extreme and melodramatic. You know, when Wanda is pressuring Gail for her answer, you know, what are you going to tell him?
Yeah, this first page is very melodramatic.
Right. And she's having these nightmares. And I thought, everybody's overreacting. But it turns out it's kind of a mystery, right? There's a picture on the bedside table. There's another guy. So that's why she can't accept his proposal if it ever comes. And then it connects to the Vietnam War. It's like, okay. Early too, right? When did you say this was?
1966. So pretty early. Yeah.
Yeah. Fairly early. So yeah, it starts out. I thought, okay, this is way too extreme. This is kind of insane. You're, you know, 3 dates in, and it's like, what are you going to say if he asks you to marry him? It's like, whoa. And are you jealous, Wanda? Are you jealous of this relationship? You're like this guy you met one time on a beach? It was like, whoa. But then it turns out, okay, I see. You know, Wanda is actually her friend, and she's actually asking the right questions. We're just not filled in on the context, and the context comes eventually. So I like it as a little romance mystery.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't sure about this guy, Richie. I thought he was trying to sort of play off both the girls, because he meets them on the beach and they have a fun day on the beach. And then he says, thanks for, you know, hanging out with me today. Can I take you both to the movies and the dinner? And he's like, you mind if I hold both your hands? I'm like, what is this guy aiming for?
Yeah. It is weird.
It is a little weird, but clearly does prefer Gail. And you can tell he does love her. He's certainly by the later in the story, be a pretty good guy. I think the mystery, as you put it, of why she feels she can't get too close to him, I think played out in a reasonable time frame. You know, it's a little, like you said, melodramatic, but I thought it was really good. And I really like the art on this one. This guy Pike is a good artist.
I think his women's arms are a bit thin. Myself, and that may be a personal.
That's true.
I mean, they're pretty twiggy, but very strong faces, right?
Yeah,
that's like
yeah.
Page.
I think I know that.
There's a page where she's biting her lip.
Page nine
of the story.
Yeah, that's a beautiful page. Yeah, beautiful.
You know,
panel.
That's really well done. The very last panel where she's finally kind of satisfied with her life and kind mm-hmm. of really good on close-ups. Good on close-ups when she's lying on her bed crying, and which is a frequent image, not just in romance comics, but in this book alone. Crying on your bed is a thing, and the day. Dates look really romantic, and when they're running, like she's running on the beach, like really great posing.
Yeah.
So yeah, good art.
Pretty good story. I do think they do make us sympathetic at the end when she runs into Peter, and Peter was the cowardly one who never bothered to contact her, which is kind of low if you ask me.
Well, they don't want us to be mad at her for abandoning a soldier.
Yeah. No, sure.
Right. So he dumped her without so much as a by your leave. And also, he's kind of a bit of a schlub in the way they draw him.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he doesn't have mustard on his tie, but he's got the burger in his mouth. It's like he's chewing while he's doing the scene.
Yeah.
It's not a good look. So you feel like, oh, yeah, Gail, you know, she did all right. We removed the guilt of abandoning a soldier who, from her point of view, was MIA. You know, she didn't know what happened to him. I think it's all like, let's wrap it up and make, if you're reading this, you don't feel that Gail sort of abandoned a service member during the war. Right.
And she's genuinely, and this is another good, you know, the conveying of her genuinely being happy at the end is really nice. I really did like the ending.
Right. I'm just going to call out on that last panel. I'm going to call out the letterer, which is often the artist in these cases. I don't know, but in this case, really overdoing it on ellipses.
Oh, yeah.
Like if you read that final panel, it's like, nobody important, darling. Ellipsis. Just ellipsis. Someone. Ellipsis. I. Ellipsis. Used. Ellipsis. To. Ellipsis, no ellipsis,
which should be a period.
It's an ellipse. Maybe the conversation continues, or maybe there's like a Morse code secret in this book. But I thought that's a little silly. But otherwise, yeah, it's a fun, it's a good story.
Yeah. So then we come to our special feature of the issue. It's called Love, Tina, which is like an advice column. And I'm not going to read these. I'll put a scan of the page in the gallery. But I do find it interesting that there are three letters with three answers from Tina, and they all involve young woman just moved to New York. They're 19 or 20 years old. It really raised the question for me about the target demographic for this book. And I don't know if you know more about that, Siskoid, than.
I think that's correct. The readership would have been young women or teenage girls looking forward to being young
Right.
women. And these are supposed to be like primers to the how to handle yourself in love. I mean, even not just these letters, but the stories. And also, let's note that we can't really trust letters pages in this era or perhaps any era. There are many stories of staffers writing them to fill up text pages. And sometimes they're like under their own name. And it's like anytime someone from New York or Long Island or something, it's like, oh my God, that's a staffer. Like you recognize the names because we're kind of comic book historians at this point. And so a sort of Dear Abby like this would have been a primo occasion to make stuff up. There's no full names, there's no addresses. These could all be made up. There are some tells. Like you said, ever since I moved to New York, And they all have the same voice as Tina, really. They all call men dolls. And I don't know how prevalent this was in this era. That's just how people talked. I don't know. But it makes me wonder if it's just not one writer filling up this page.
Yeah. Well, it was an entertaining read. I'll put
Oh,
it
yeah.
on there and our listeners can judge for themselves. Then we come to a short one called I Couldn't Be Faithful, 8 pages. Again, not sure who the writer was. And this time the penciler and inker is Tony Abruzzo. And this was reprinted from Heartthrobs number 117 from 1968. Do you want to do the honors on this one, Siskoid?
Sure. Gwen Stacy lookalike Lisa was in love with Peter, but not that one. And they were going to be married when he graduated, but she kept accepting dates from other men against the advice of her roommate, Glory, and she couldn't explain why. Finally, she's caught with another man by Peter, and she can't explain it to him either. Sobbing, she runs home and has a nightmare. You gotta have your nightmares. She recalls her parents' funeral. No one wanted to take her as a child, resulting in feelings of inadequacy and a need to be loved by, well, anyone. Confessing this realization to Peter, he forgives her and tells her that he will fill her so full of love, if you know what I mean, that there won't be room for anyone else, if you know what I mean. The
Yeah.
end.
This one I personally thought was the weakest from a story standpoint, but the art
Yes.
is pretty striking. I mean, this woman, if you look at that splash page, you tell me that's not Gwen Stacy.
Yeah, this is Gwen Stacy precedes this by like 3 years or so,
I know.
but they're really trying to be hip,
Yes.
very hip. Romance comics artists had to keep up with the fashion. That's certainly something that you see. I mean, Gwen
Yeah.
Stacy was designed by a romance comics artist, John Romita. So it makes sense that this is part of that tradition. All of these people have hip haircuts and hip clothes, and it's very up to date. You're right. That's the most striking thing about this.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, and you got to make all the boys look different, and because she dates quite a lot of men.
Yeah.
But in terms of the story,
I was kind of searching for the point of it. She loves this guy, but she likes to go swinging out with these other guys to clubs and stuff. He catches her, and she's like, I don't know. And then she just has the realization from the dream of the funeral, and he forgives her. And I'm like, is there a message? And the only message I could think of was, don't two-time your solid boyfriend. But I thought the art was really neat. I did notice, I don't know if you noticed this, girl's eye makeup was much darker and prevalent than the other heroines in the story.
Yeah, well, it's totally, like I said, this particular artist really was up to, looking at the fashions and doing clothes that were trendy at the time, hair, makeup that was trendy at the time. So they don't look like, even if she's Gwen Stacy never had this much eye makeup or,
No.
and the clothes would have been up to date 1968, presumably. I think he's doing like a good job of filling up the panels with something you would recognize at the time. It's a nice little time capsule. Whereas a lot of comics have a sort of general sense of a decade. That's how we still get Batman 89 still looks like the 1940s. And it's like there's a
Yeah.
comic book aesthetic that is accepted among designers. The Spider-Man comics would have looked like this as well. Under John Romita, it's felt very trendy in
Yeah.
terms of what people wore and looked like. I think the point of this story is to say that we have may have a personal trauma, like she has a childhood trauma that is driving her to be, in 70s parlance, loose,
Yeah.
a loose lady. And I mean, they're calling doctors. It's very much still of the time. It's like Mad Men. You're calling doctors to tranquilize your wife or girlfriend. But at least she makes that realization that, ah, oh, yes. That's where it comes from. I have a fear of abandonment. And so I skip around because I'm afraid that the current boyfriend will abandon me and I don't want to be without a plan B, C, D through Z. It's a psychological story. It's
Yeah.
just in 8 pages, it's going to be what it's going to be.
I agree. And finally, we get to our last story, which is just slightly more than half the book. It's called Love Is What It's All About. It's a novel length, as advertised, as you mentioned, 33 pages total. And that's because it was reprinted from three different issues of Young Romance. Young Romance number 154, 155, and 156. 1968, only 2 years earlier. Again, we don't know who the writer was, but penciled by Mike Sekowski of Justice League fame and inked by Joe Orlando himself. I just found this very interesting that they had this multi-part story, and I do want to talk about the various parts of it. So let's get into it. In part one, we are introduced to beautiful and hardworking social worker Lynn Olin. One day, as she is leaving an appointment with a family, her purse is stolen by the troubled son, Angelo. He is stopped by a handsome police officer, Vince Sadek. But Lynn declines to press charges, much to the chagrin of Officer Sadek. Vince and Lynn have coffee and find out that despite their differences, they are attracted to each other. But as they grow closer, Lynn feels that she has so much to do, she has no time for love. When she visits Angelo's family again, she finds that he has cleaned up his act and is returning to school. He wants to treat her to a cup of coffee to celebrate. But who else has he invited? Vince. Lynn and Vince have a happy reunion, realizing how much they do mean to each other, as Angelo explains, "Love, baby, that's what it's all about."
Let me pick it up. In part two, Lynn and Vince's relationship deepens as Vince tells her that she's too serious and needs to have a little fun. Cue the montage scene of nightclubs, dancing, and even bowling. She worries about his dangerous life as a police officer, but realizes that she can't control that. Her professional life is going well, too. The only warning sign is that Vince is not a fan of her cultural interests. She drags him to a play with cultural significance. But he doesn't dig it. Despite their disagreements, the pair plan to be married. Lynn is so happy as the wedding approaches, but on the day of the wedding, Lynn is paid a visit from Vince's partner, Phil. Vince has been killed by some hold-up men as he was attempting to stop a robbery. As part two closes, Lynn rips up her wedding dress and thinks she'll never love again.
In part three, Lynn's roommate Peg tries to cheer her up. In addition, she's visited several times by Phil to help console her. But Lynn rebels, yelling at Peg and storming out. She falls in with the wrong crowd, staying out late and even calling in sick to work to go shopping. She eventually even gets fired from the job she used to love. She continues her wild ways and eventually is even responsible for an accident while necking with a driver. He actually dies while Lynn is subjected to a long hospital stay. But Phil is there visiting her every day. She says, "I didn't think you ever want to see me again, Phil." But he responds that he is in love with the woman she used to be. They kiss as we reach the end. So let's take this part one, two, and three at a time.
Yeah.
So what'd you think of part one, Siskoid? Let's start there.
Part one, first, great splash to
Yeah,
begin
beautiful.
with. It's interesting. I think Sekowski is, who may have written this, like he's a writer as well. So I don't know. They just can't pin that down. It really gives them room to breathe because it is a three-parter. Like this story has a lot of big splashes, big emotional moments, montages. We take it slower. In a way, it still tells three different stories. So in the first part, I found it interesting that they called her a social investigator. It just makes him more heroic, which is a social worker, you know. And you know it's a poor neighborhood that she visits because people dress like they're in Eastern Europe. Did anyone else think that Angelo would be the love interest in this part of it? Because there's sort of a rom-com, I hate you, trying to help you. And of course, the conservative cop and the liberal social worker aren't the most natural match either, right? So that also works as a rom-com type story.
I got the feeling that Angelo was a little younger than that. It's hard to tell from the drawings now that I go back and look at it. But now you say that, I did not have that feeling. I just thought he
They
was.
want him to get a job, don't they?
Well, they wanted him to go back to school.
Okay.
He goes back to school. So I assumed he was in high school, but you
Okay.
know. I think he had dropped out of school and was having trouble holding down a job. Maybe I'm inferring all this stuff. I'd have to go back and check it.
No,
But
I think that makes sense, especially if they're poor. It's just in my head, school meant college or something. But you're
right.
right that this family and their socioeconomic situation may not be able to afford that. So, yeah, your story makes more sense than mine. But at the same time, it's like you're a conservative cop and I'm a liberal social worker. I don't know if we can make this work. Let's date and find out, you know? Okay.
Sitcom ready, man.
Right. And I thought there was something more sinister about the cop because of his name. It's called Vince Sadek. And I mean, in French, sadistic is simply sadique. So I thought, okay, are they doing like a play where he's, because he is kind of not cruel, but he is a more brutal character than like she's a bleeding heart compared to him. So I thought, is that what they're doing? I mean, she's called Lynn Olin. Like her parents didn't do her a good turn there. But so I didn't know if there was like supposed to be something coded in the name. Turns out not really. Although I feel like as we move on and she's going to get married to this guy, I was like, no, don't.
Yeah. He's going to squash her down. Yeah.
I felt like she would get lost in this. I mean, one of the things that we often see in romance comics is the plot where the motivation has to be, I need to get married. In this era, yeah, I need to get married, but also, oh no, this automatically will mean that I lose my career. You know, it's like in that Star Trek episode where in TOS, where Kirk marries or is about to marry a couple, and it's like, and then she'll go out of the service. You know, that we'd lose an officer. And
Right.
why? You know, why would you lose an officer? It was expected that a married woman would stop working. So you get that feeling here. For her, social work is more than just
Yeah.
a job. It's a vocation. It's like she's passionate about it. Going out with this guy would mean it's why there's at the end she at the end of the part one she doesn't want to date him anymore, doesn't want to continue this relationship, is that she's not done with her passion project, with her vocation. She's got so many plans.
Yeah, bottom of page eight, and it's a nice panel. I tell you, I'm not a huge fan of Sikowski on his Justice League. I mean, I like it, the kinetic energy he brings, but I never thought of him as being a very subtle artist.
Okay.
But I do like the way he lays the story out. I like the expressions on the face, and a lot of that might be Orlando too doing the inks. But I was pretty impressed with the art, and I do like the panel you're referring to at the bottom of page eight quite a bit. I think that's a really telling panel.
Where she looks into space while she's dancing close with the Doctor Who thing. We hug because we don't want to show our faces. And that's where her real expression is, where her real emotion is hidden from him. But Angelo turns out to be like the Cupid in the story.
Yeah, I did think that was cute. I thought that was a nice ending. And I felt like the first part, so if we talk about just the parts, part one,
Yep, part
I
one.
felt was a complete story.
It could have ended there.
It could have very well ended there, and we would have assumed they lived happily ever after, right?
Correct.
So then we moved to part two. Tell me what you think of the happenings in part two.
Part two has the, for me, the red flag is in part two, which is the theater date, right? That's in part two.
Yep.
Like he brings her to like dancing girls, and that's his kind of entertainment. And she brings him to the play that he already decides from the beginning that he's gonna think, he thinks that's gonna suck.
Right.
And he complains all the way through.
Yeah, that's the one time he was really unlikable. Like you could see that he was disappointed in her, that she didn't want to press charges and felt she was too, soft touch or whatever.
Yeah.
But the play thing, not giving her, a chance to show him something that meant something to her, made him unlikable in that regard.
Right.
I did think she was especially cute bowling, by the way.
Yeah.
The shots on page three, where she's wearing this sort of green and white top.
She jumps around while
She
she's
jumps
jumping in.
up. Yeah, she's
Yeah.
cute there. She's so excited she got a strike. And I do like the fact that Sikowski took the time to draw bowling shoes on the two of them, opposed to elsewhere. She's in heels and such. I thought that was a nice little touch. She didn't have to do that, but I did like that quite a bit.
Right. I don't know if it's necessarily on purpose, but it does feel like she's always a pretty girl. But when she's really happy, when she's dating him, and that like that page three of part two, she's really beautiful. There seems to be a glow up in terms of the art making her cuter.
Yeah, she's definitely cute.
Even the art kind of shows us like she's conflicted. And yes, I am this character, and I want to keep doing my work. But look how happy I am. You know, like the art is doing that. Sikowski's doing a lot of these little moments throughout. We jump from, you know, moment to moment. It goes really quite
It is very
quickly.
quick. Yeah, I agree.
And you got your later on page four of that part where Peg is like doing yoga or just exercises, or you know,
Yeah.
it's like instead of just putting the characters like being talking heads, they're doing things.
Yeah, that's
There's
nice.
action in the frame. So I really appreciate, you know, how lively the story is.
Yeah, and so then they get into the whole issue of, oh, he's got a dangerous career because he's a police officer,
Right.
as opposed to he was a bit of a jerk to her. So a couple mixed messages there, but I'm looking forward to it. They go to the wedding rehearsal. They start on the thank you note. She's so happy. And then Phil shows up with the news that he's dead. And man, she shreds that dress to pieces on page 10, huh?
These things cost money.
I know, really. She should have returned it for getting her money back.
You know, if this were a House of Mystery type story,
Yeah.
Angela would have been the killer.
Oh,
Like he disappears. He's not in part two or anything. So it's like she tries to help a youth in crisis, and the youth ends up shooting the cop. You know, it's all kind of accidental, and like part three will tell us what happened. That's not what happens. You know, it's not that kind of story.
So then we move to part three. We see a montage of the funeral and going through pictures, and she's like, I'm never going to love anybody. And she secludes herself in her apartment. And Phil, I don't know whether he's taken the opportunity or I want to think Phil's a good guy, but we never really get to know Phil at all.
No.
He keeps showing up at the apartment. He feels, I mean, Vince was his partner, so he does feel
He
some
feels
sense of
responsibility, yeah.
to help her through this. And I get that. Of course, we kind of figure where this is going. He falls for her pretty hard.
Yeah, I'm not big on that part. I think she should be untouchable. But at the same time, like, I think maybe the story would have worked better if he was really kind of dating Peg or something, right? This is a trend throughout this issue. Every story is like this. The brunette never gets the guy. The guy's never interested in the brunette. If there's a choice, he chooses the fair-haired
Blonde
character
or
who
the
is,
red hair. Yeah, you're right.
yeah, either the strawberry blonde or blonde. I mean, it happens over and over, and I think that is a trope to a point, because I've read a lot of romance comic stories and it's not always the case. But in this issue, it certainly is. Like at first, like he shows up and it's Peg opening the door, and it's Peg putting the flowers in a vase. And so I felt like, okay, he has a little casual romance with Peg, and later she calls them her best friends. It's like, these are my best friends. It's like, okay, well, they're a couple then. That's how you refer to
Yeah, a couple friend,
your
yeah.
a couple, you know, friends as a couple. So that he then ends up with her has felt a little weird. It's like it felt like all these stories need to end with the girl being married off or partnered off. And that's why I kind of appreciated
The
the
first one.
racing story
Yeah.
and how that didn't happen.
Right. No, I get you. The conclusion wasn't entirely satisfactory to me either. I don't know whether they rushed it or whether it could have been a four-parter or what, but my main thing is we never really get to know Phil. We spend a lot of time with Lynn going down the bad girl route, right? She starts going out with some shady characters. She's smoking on page five, dancing, buying a new wardrobe, looking pretty good on that could have been a mod Wonder Woman pose on page seven by Sikowski. And then even gets fired from her job. But then she's like, yeah, whatever. He didn't like my dresses like everybody else did. She's definitely shielding herself or running away from her grief, I guess.
And being a slut can kill.
That's clearly the message because she's like gets picked up by this other guy and she starts kissing him and he's driving and they have an accident and the guy is killed. I'm like, wow.
He goes hard, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, he's kissing a woman, eyes closed, while driving.
Yeah, not a very, very smart thing to do, no question about it. But
Yeah.
a part of me was like, why does Phil want her at this point? Again, we didn't get to see the development of that road. Like, as much as maybe we didn't like Vince that much, we got to see the development of their relationship, right? They go out, they do things, they sort of talk it out. Maybe we didn't like Vince, but at least we got to see their courtship, as it were, right?
Yeah.
Here, we don't have any idea why Phil loves her or why she loves him.
Except the cliche of the partner who falls for
Yeah.
the, by comforting the grieving girlfriend, he sort of inveigles himself into her emotions.
I guess.
And it happens in real life, I get it, but I think there's a shortcut to this. It's like, yeah, I get it because I've seen it in other things, but that just makes it a cliche.
I did really enjoy this long, epic length story quite a bit. I thought it was really neat.
Plenty of twists.
Yeah, plenty of twists. The three-parter, like I was trying to think what it would be like if you only got the middle story, for example.
Middle story. I mean, it's possible. It's like sometimes they start it because of the confessional element. The first person, you say, well, I've been in a relationship with this guy, and we're not quite compatible. He's a cop, though. I'm kind of afraid something will happen. Something does happen on wedding night. Ah,
Right.
the end.
That's tough to get that one if that was the only. Orlando as an editor, I think in general, didn't necessarily take from the same reasoning that the sort of the Julie Schwartz every comic book is somebody's first. Mort Weisinger, Julie Schwartz, Jim Shooter, those guys all, hey, all these stories, every comic book somebody first, which is why you have all those
Right.
long recaps and
So
stuff.
yeah, they wouldn't have done like three parts without
Yeah.
recapping everything.
Yeah. I mean, and we do get a recap of sorts as a lot of text on splash page of part two and part three, but still, it seems a little different for 1968 when it came out, which I thought was pretty neat.
Yeah, I think some people say that the Bronze Age really starts around 1968, you know, the hard traveling heroes and that kind of stuff. Comics start to modernize in the late 60s. I prefer to say it's when Jack Kirby jumps to DC, that's a good mark for me, because he was a Golden Age artist, a Silver Age artist, and then becomes a Bronze Age icon as well. So that's all debatable. So I feel like we are seeing comics get more modern. This may be, you know, a symptom of that.
I mean, these three stories after, I would argue, are not quite as modern as the first story, which is firmly set 1970 from when it was written. But I agree with you 100%.
I mean, this is still, you know, across the several stories, there's still a pretty high body count for a romance comic.
That's true.
We've killed three people.
Pretty funny.
I don't think that's usual. I don't feel like that's normal.
Yeah, well, tragedy will bring people together.
Yeah, tragedy. Yeah, you get that. But these are killings. One guy bumps a car into the wall. And in this story, one guy is killed by Hold Up Man, and this guy is killed by Kiss.
Metaphor for our time, boys. Any boy that happens to pick us book up, watch out for those girls.
Yes, cooties will kill.
So, I mean, that kind of brings us to the end. Overall, I ask everybody, Siskoid, do you think this comic lived up to its special billing?
Well, it does two special things, in my opinion. One is collecting a rare multi-part story, right? It's like you said, it's like this feels like we weren't there yet. So it's almost like an early trade, if we want to call it.
Yeah, that. Yeah, absolutely.
And the other is the groovy cover and then commissioning a completely new story based on it. Like the cover is so strong that we have to put a new story in this book.
Yeah.
So it does make it special.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. I agree. I think it's a fun thing. I wouldn't know how to distinguish some romance stories over another, having not read them enough. But I did enjoy going through this one and talking about it. And just the added bonus of getting to hear from Charlie himself about the cover was just a fun aspect of this whole situation. So I did appreciate that. I guess that's it. Thank you for joining me, Siskoid. Do you want to tell our listeners what you're currently working on?
Well, I'm still writing daily articles at siskoid.blogspot.com. And I'd love to have more eyes on the blog. These days, it's still going strong after, you know, I just entered the 20th year.
Wow, that's amazing.
I think it's still interesting. On the network, I am not sure what my plans are for 2026, other than for sure continuing Oh Hot More Knots and Who's Hot and Who's Not, depending on the month, with the Hot Squad and FW Team Up, of course, with my various guest hosts. Of those, you can be sure. However, if you've never listened to Lonely Hearts, the Romance Comics podcast, I'm quite proud of that. It's the first show I did on FNW. It's funny. It's got some production value. It's not just romance comics. There's a lot of production on just like the theater portion of it. It's like little plays, and it's got a lot of voices that you'll recognize from across the blogosphere or the podcastosphere. You know, check it out. It's all on Fire and Water Podcast Network.
You know, this has given me an impetus. I know I listened probably close to 10 years ago now to a couple episodes of that, but I have not listened since then to those shows. I may go back and listen to some of those. This has piqued my interest to listen to some more.
Right. And we play it for comedy. It's like,
yeah, sure, of course.
I'm with some clowns there, and it's not like if you're not interested in the academic,
right?
The academics of romance comics, we make fun of it. We have fun with it. We make fun of it. It doesn't feel like we're mocking it either. It's, you know, it's just, I don't know. I feel like it struck the right tone. So it should be fun.
I think all these things, the way I look at the comics I like to review, I like to point out the silly things and the fun stuff on it, but that doesn't mean these
dislike
are not of value, or that we dislike it, or we were judging them in a poor way. These comics are great. Part of the whole point of this show and others like it is to bring some of that back to light. But you can't not laugh at a lot of this stuff because it's funny.
I feel like I have to preface it or excuse it in advance, because my bread and butter in the podcasting world is kind of it's the podcast you didn't know you wanted. And so when you look at that's what it's about, then I'm not interested. I'm telling you, it's not what you think it is. Check it out. Should be fun.
All right. Well, thank you again, Siskoid. So now, listeners, I'm going to play a short promo. And when I return, you will hear the second installment of Catch You Later Calculator with my bat brother, Sean M. Myers, plus my next episode announcement and listener feedback. So stay tuned.
The Lonely Hearts Romance Comics Podcast, in which four guys talk about romance comics and about romances in comics, with Siskoid.
We're all French Canadians here.
Marty.
In horror comics, there's often like this little, you know, romance tinge, I guess.
Okay.
Bass.
We just turned on him.
And yours truly, Fern.
I'm very aroused.
Featuring the overproduced wonder that is romance comics theater every episode.
Dan, I knew it couldn't last from the first day you eyeballed me when
I reported to work. It wouldn't matter if I washed in laundry soap and came to work in a burlap sack. I'd turn you on. And you have the same effect on me.
I do?
The Lonely Hearts Romance Comics Podcast, available on iTunes.
We had a comic book romance.
Siskoid's blog of geekery is Doctor Who,
Babylon 5,
animation,
comics,
toys,
Godzilla,
Star Trek,
cats,
crypto,
role-playing games,
battle shovel,
X-Files,
music,
podcast,
board games,
Jack Kirby,
alien
movie,
kung fu,
dinosaur,
and so much more. Siskoid's blog of geekery, 10 years of content, more than 7,500 posts, still going strong at siskoid.blogspot.com.
Welcome back. It's now time for another special conversation with my bat brother, Sean M. Myers. We are reviewing Bob Rozakis' 1976 epic from the back pages of Detective Comics in a segment that we call...
Catch you later, calculator. This month we are covering two stories from Detective 464 and 465. First up, we get the Black Canary. Detective Comics number 464, cover date October 1976. The on-sale date is July 29th, 1976. The editor is Julius Schwartz. And yes, you can read this entire story arc on the DC Universe Infinite app. Now, we're not going to talk about the cover, or at least Black Canary, because she's not on the cover.
Yep, unfortunately, you got another nice Ernie Chua cover with Batman versus the Black Spider, but no Black Canary. So we'll move on.
The title is A Hot Time in Star City Tonight. An incredible six pages featuring Black Canary, written by Bob Rozakis, penciled by Mike Grell, and inked by Terry Austin. We open our story as Black Canary is finishing up her shift on the all-important monitor duty in the JLA satellite. The Atom has arrived for his turn and is telling Dinah about his battle with the calculator last month and the fact that he has already escaped prison. The blonde bombshell brushes him off. She is in a hurry to get back to Star City, where she is a guest of honor at the city's tricentennial celebration. When she materializes back on Earth, she lands right in the path of a truck. She has to use her canary cry to stop the truck, and thank goodness it works. But we find out that the driver of the truck is none other than the calculator in civilian guise, who calculated that she would land there, and he wanted her to use her power. A little later, the canary is on her motorcycle heading for the celebration and notices that it's a hot one today in Star City. As she looks at a sign on a local bank, she sees that the temperature is rising fast. 97 degrees, 104 degrees, 115 degrees, 128 degrees. And no, we have no idea what that is in Celsius for you, Martin. As the heat keeps increasing, guess who shows up? That's right. The calculator, on a bike of his own. Some awesome Mike Grell fisticuffs ensue, and we are now up to 186 degrees. The calculator has made it so hot in Star City that the residents cannot enjoy their big parade and party. As Canary sweats and fends off Calculator's fighting hand constructs, he monologues that he is using her own sonic scream as the power for the heat wave. Dinah gambles and gives it all she's got with one last canary cry. She's right. It overpowers the calculator's device and overheats to the extreme that his equipment begins to melt. We see the temperature get as high as 526 degrees, but it drops right back down to a temperate 87 after the damage has been done. The calculator has just enough time to press his special button before the Black Canary punches him out. As he broods in jail, the calculator is glad that even though Star City was able to have its celebration, his overall plan was still a success. Next up, the Elongated Man.
What'd you think of this one, Sean? Have you recovered from last month?
I do like this one. Very similar to what I said last month. Very action-packed. Absolutely beautiful, wonderful, fantastic Mike Grell art.
If possible, even better art than last month. I agree.
And it's funny. I think I may go out on a limb, and some of it may be having to do with recency bias. But if I think about my favorite artists from the 70s, especially like this time period, automatically you think Neil Adams.
Yep. I don't know. I'm thinking Mike Grell, he might just have that edge. I don't know.
Well, he had a lot of great stuff in the 70s. He did a lot of the Green Lantern, Green Arrow, or Green Lantern anyway, backups in The Flash. He did Legion. He did this stuff. He did some Batman, not a ton, but some. Then when they brought Green Lantern, Green Arrow back, that's when I first started buying Green Lantern, was that first issue. And I actually got him to sign that comic, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, number 90. Just great. And he draws an absolutely gorgeous Black Canary. No question about it.
Even I can see that. Yes.
Yeah. On the first page, I love how Canary's like, yeah, whatever, Adam. He's like, I got to get out of here. I got a party to go to. You'd almost see him patting him on his tiny head, right?
That's why this part of the podcast is only going to be 3 minutes long. It's the same thing.
So we get the Adam in the second panel there, sitting in the monitor duty in his little tiny chair,
Yeah.
right? The Adam has to be tiny. Why does he have to be tiny on monitor duty? I don't know, but he is. He likes to sit in his little tiny chair, which is great. I thought when the Justice League satellite transporters, I thought they had transport tubes, right? That they were on the building in all their heroes' cities and convenient spots. And this one happens to just deposit her on this middle of the street. The calculator calculated that.
Yeah, like we talked about last month. How in the world calculate that the Atom would send her there? Bob, I love you and everything, but and it's a great story. What ensues is great, but how do you calculate that?
It makes a little more sense if you think it he is affecting things and he's saying he's calculating things to make him sound to justify his name, I guess. I don't know. When you turn the page, she says, "Oh no." And this at this time her power was erratic. Nowadays that's just her power. She has the canary cry, but at the time she didn't use it all the time because it didn't always work or didn't always work right. She screams at the car and stops the car. And the calculator, who we see has red curly hair. So there you go. We don't get his name, but we see what he looks like without his costume. Still with the maniacal little smile in the middle of the page on page two, which I love. And she's like, oh man, that was weird. Why did that happen? Right? Well, we don't know. And then she starts seeing the temperature go up. So give me some comments on the range of temperatures that we see in this story, Sean.
In this part, it's 97, 104, 115 to 128, and that's in less than a minute.
It's getting hot quick. She's sweating away and she's like, what's going on? And then we get again, he's cool, right? He's driving a motorcycle now. He uses the motorcycle. You know, like they do in movies where they jump on top of a car on the motorcycle to launch the motorcycle in the air right at the Black Canary.
Since the last month since we've recorded, we've gotten a ton of hate mail from me because I don't like the calculator or these stories. Like 33,000 emails and letters and
Yeah, I'm
postcards.
gonna edit them down to not
Yeah,
make them.
that because I don't like the calculator. I'll tell you one thing. The calculator has a fantastic chopper. This is like from Wheelie and the Chopper Bunch because it has like that super long, not elongated, but like a super long front, not spoke,
Axle or
axle.
stem or
Yeah, the
whatever it
super
is,
long
yeah.
axle that's in front of that. That's a fantastic motorcycle.
Cool looking hog. And she uses her power again. So this the internal logic of this makes sense because we find out shortly that he is using her power to somehow power his computer stuff to make the heat rise. So in some ways, it's kind of a precursor of data farms that we have now that use up all this power and make the ozone layer go away or something.
I am going to jump ahead just a little bit because since I said something nice about calculator, I kind of like want to double down on that so people don't think I hate the calculator. I do like this. So the calculator says, I channeled your sonic song through my computer system and used its vibrations to set the air molecules moving.
Right.
Molecules in motion generate heat. Hallelujah. We have
logic.
a reason. Yeah, I will accept that. So, yay.
That part of it makes total sense. Even before that, we get some great action. Doc Canary does this flip. It's now up to 186 degrees. And then he's going tick, 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 beep, 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 beep on his chest. And fists, like Green Lantern fists, Now, they're not pink this time. They're kind of light blue.
Gotta say.
I don't know what, that's just a coloring choice or what. They're coming out of his forehead, and they're battling the Black Canary. And I love how there's four, and then there's six, and she's like, boom, 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 boom. She's trying to bat all the fists out of the way. That's really cool.
Yeah, it starts to get four hands coming against her. And I do think it's like when you see super great action movies, face-to-face, hand-to-hand. They're grabbing each other, putting away, and then like getting the other one, and then going. And then like I think that looks really great.
Yeah, it does look great. And you can feel the kinetic action. I mean, Mike Grell is really good. We get a shot of the bridge and all the people marching out of town because it's so hot, they walk out of town. Right? I guess maybe all the cars are melted. I don't know. They're all walking on the bridge. There's like the bridge is full of people walking out of town where apparently it's much cooler on the other side of the bridge. He tells her, if you do use your power anymore to defeat me, the city will melt. It's going to get so hot.
Now, Paul, I hope that you had the exact same thought when you saw this panel of the city melting. I hope you imagined that there were candles and that the Manhattan was melting. This is a callback to The Outsider and Batman Family.
I had the same thought. I knew you would think that. But Dinah takes a gamble and it pays off. She lets loose with her biggest ever canary cry and overheats the calculator. Again, that logic, assuming that he has this device that can use her power to make things hotter, that all makes perfect sense, comic book wise, right?
Yes, I'm fine with that, yes.
There's no calculating going on there. He's using the technology to somehow funnel her power against the city, and she figures out that by overloading it, it'll break it and come back to normal. I'm on board with all that, right?
Yes. However, as this is happening, the temperature is getting hotter. And by hotter, before I say this, I understand that the internet didn't exist in 1976, right? Yeah, 76. I understand that you couldn't just look up facts. However, as this is going on, the temperature, which was, 186, it now gets up to 215 degrees.
Which is boiling.
And then it goes up to 526 degrees. And I can tell you right now, I was just talking about Google, and I thought about Googling, can human beings live in 526 degrees? And I'm like, what are you doing? We can't. So maybe it was just
for a second.
We are seeing this on a bank monitor. I don't know what this is made out of. I would think it would probably melt. Now, I will say, I don't know what the melting point of, I guess, metal would be and light bulbs. My calculator no prize is, I guess it's just the air up there that's that hot. And maybe it's only 200 degrees down here.
But of course, his thing starts to melt. He hits a special button beforehand. Black Canary punches him out. And I love the last two panels. He's grumpy in the jail cell, but I was able to push my special button, which we still don't know what that's for yet. That we do get a payoff. And I love the little panel at the end. She's standing on the star for Star City. Yeah. It's 300 years. She's got her arms raised like, yeah, that's right. I'm your big hero. That's because my boyfriend's not around. I'm here. You know, kind of thing. Just terrific. And then we find out that the elongated man is next. Any final thoughts on this story, Sean?
Well, I have a question for you.
Yeah. What's your question?
What is the calculator's real name?
We talked about that last time. We don't know. The police know because he is in jail. We love Bob, but he doesn't always name characters. We still don't know. I'm calling him Noah because that's what the post-crisis calculator name is. We're going to find out if we do get his name before the end of our miniseries here.
Because earlier we were talking about Batman Family and there was the 5-in-1 foe and we never got his name.
Never got his name. And he had five different. Before we leave the story, Sean, I do want to say, I don't know if you noticed this, but in the credit box, it says story, Bob and Lori Razakis. I don't know whether she really liked the Black Canary or something or came up with a key ingredient, or maybe she knew that people can survive 526 degrees. I don't know. Or maybe she came up with the logic. And that's why this story made sense. I don't know, but Lori Razakis has a co-credit for the story of that. So I just wanted to say that before we moved on to the next issue. All right, now we're going to move on to Detective number 465, cover dated November of 76, on sale August 31st of 1976. Again, edited, of course, by Julie Schwartz. Yes, you can read it on DC Universe. And we get a little tiny picture of the elongated man in the bottom right corner of the cover. It's another Ernie Chua cover, Batman crashing through the skylight to save Commissioner Gordon, as he does. And we just get a little picture of, I assume it's by Ernie Chua, of Ralph sort of stretching his neck, and we just get his sort of a headshot with his long neck. The title of our story is The Elongated Plague. It's 6 pages long, written by Bob, penciled by Ernie Chan, and inked by Terry Austin. So Sean, you want to tell our Calkill listeners about the story?
The day after Star City's tricentennial celebration, we see everybody's favorite superhero couple, Ralph and Sue Dibney, strutting down the street. They are in town because the famous Elongated Man has been invited to be the guest of honor at the local Comic-Con. They pass by a news dealer hawking a newspaper with a headline about Black Canary foiling the Calculator the day before. But the news agent is the Calculator. He's already escaped and was waiting for them. He wastes no time as he shoots laser light beams at Ralph from his trusty forehead LCD. But strangely, it turns out that the laser beams are harmless, or so we think. The Calculator claims he is not really the Calculator and is just cosplaying and on his way to the Comic-Con too. Ralph signs an autograph for him and the couple heads to the show. But as Ralph starts to meet his fans, all of a sudden, they all start to stretch out of control and they can't snap back to normal. The fans all blame Ralph as the Calculator watches the melee. His plan was to steal Elongated Man's fame. And he's gonna live forever? That's my fame joke. It's Paul's fame jokes, and I really appreciate that he put that in so I could do that. But in the confusion, Ralph notices that the Calculator is standing completely still and surmises that is how he is maintaining his shape. So he starts pulling on him like taffy, and the Calculator gives in to tick-tick-tock-tock-tocking his keyboard and returning everybody to normal. Ralph knocks him right into a box full of Golden Age comics and returns the Calculator to jail. Next up, Green Arrow.
So what do you think of this one?
I do like this one. I like Ernie Chua. I like him a lot. Now, I do think it does pale in comparison by a few degrees. Now, not as many
526?
Degrees. Yes, not that many degrees. It does pale compared to Mike Grell before. But there's a lot of cool, fun, silly, neat art in this.
Yeah.
So that's super
makes up for it. Yeah, I agree with that. Ralph is a fun character, right? I do think it's neat that they comment on the fact that despite Green Arrow and Black Canary both living in Star City, they invited Ralph to the Comic-Con to be the guest of honor because he's the most courageous, because he's the only one who's told everybody his secret identity. I thought that was a really nice touch.
I kind of think it does make sense, especially this is like the day after the whatever Star City Founders Day or whatever. Black Canary would have had her moment. And it does make sense. That's who lives there. So it does make sense to bring someone else in this case, Elongated Man.
It's funny, right in the third panel, you see the Calculator selling newspaper and Ralph's eyeballs go zooming out of his head.
Like a Tex Avery cartoon.
And you know, it's interesting. I know that recently on the Fantastic Four, a couple months ago, Brett was talking about how Mr. Fantastic rarely stretches his neck and weird body parts, I guess, because it looks a little more silly. And like Elongated Man, especially Plastic Man, are much more humorous characters. So it makes more sense for them to do silly things. I never had thought about it that way. But if you really think back about how they use their powers, it's generally two. So I wanted to give Brett props there because I thought of that when I was preparing here. If this is a joke and he's just a cosplayer, how many cosplayers have laser beams in their forehead thing?
Yeah,
come on, Ralph. You're a detective, Ralph. But anyway, he says, no, I was just kidding. Can't you take a joke? I'm just headed to the Comic-Con. And he says it's too early because it's the next day. The newspapers haven't come out that said the Calculator's already escaped. Trying to confuse Ralph there. And I guess it works because Ralph's like, oh, okay, here you go. Here's your autograph.
I do think that's a valid point, especially back then.
Yeah.
You'd have TV news that could report it. But yeah, like the newspaper.
You don't have it on your phone. You wouldn't have gotten an alert. Oh, villain Calculator has escaped.
Yeah. It would be a purple alert because of his costume.
Yep. And then we get this bottom page of two. Earlier on, I said, you know, Calculator, it seems to me works a little better if he's making things happen. Like he made the trap happen for Black Canary, or not the trap, but he made the technology. Technology happen for her powers to go out of whack. And so a little rocket ship comes and visits him in jail so he can escape. And he doesn't say, the rocket ship I pre-programmed has come to rescue me. He says, oh, as I calculated, this little rocket ship just happens to fly in my jail window. I'm like, come on, Bob. As a kid, right over my head. Now, I'm like, come on.
When he tries to explain stuff, it just gets worse.
Right. So they go into the Comic-Con, page 3. This might be my favorite page, where we had a lot of great Mike Grell action the last two stories. This one is great because all the people at the Comic-Con start stretching out of control, and it's hysterical.
Yes, it is. Yes. I love it.
I would bet most comic book fans love to see this kind of stuff where normal people are dressed up. It's kind of like, I mean, it's kind of a horrible story, but the story where Flash and Iris go to a Halloween party. Yeah. Anytime there's other people dressed as heroes, it's always neat. I was hoping to see some Marvel representation.
We didn't get that this time.
No. I didn't see it, but it is neat because you have some guy dressed up like Green Lantern because he has glasses on. Even though there's a blonde-haired Aquaman, it doesn't look like Aquaman.
Right. So it's great. You got all these guys. The one guy who's dressed like Superman, kind of an overweight guy that's balding, he kind of looked like Julie Schwartz. So I kind of thought that was funny.
Oh, actually, so late breaking news. The panel after that one with the portly Superman, there's a guy in a green and black striped shirt. So maybe that could be Sandman.
That might have been Sandman. We get this great panel at the end of this page where the calculator is standing real still. He's got his arms folded. He's leaning up against the wall. And you get this, again, like a cartoon, a cloud of dust as all these people are fighting and nodding. Yeah. And all we see are arms and legs and fans and stuff stretching out of it. All the fans are mad at Ralph. Now, how do you get about the fans turning on Ralph so quickly? He's supposed to be their favorite. And then 2 seconds, okay, we're all stretching out of control. It must be your fault. So then now we're all going to be mad at him.
So two things. He's saying, I'm not responsible for this. This isn't my problem. The part that you're stealing his fame.
Yeah.
If people are mad at you, I guess you could be infamous, I guess, but you're not really stealing. I think stealing his fame would be like somehow making these people forget that they know who Elongated Man is. If you're really going to, like, quote unquote, steal his fame.
Yeah, I think when we get to the last issue, I'm going to go out on a limb and say Bob hadn't figured this all out until he got to the last.
Yeah. That limb is about as sturdy as a building.
There is a reason for him to face off and lose against all these different, as crazy as that reason might be, there is a reason, but we won't get to the last chapter. But none of that's apparent in his crimes. You know, we've had him heat up the city to steal the celebration, earthquake to murder this guy, pretty brutal to weird to just kind of comical. So he's all over the place in his evil deeds. I think he's just saying, what can I have this crazy calculator guy do this month? And then he's like, what? Oh, you want me to wrap it up now, Julie? Okay. Comic books are flying around, people fighting. And then another great page where Ralph, it sticks his head out of the cloud of people battling and sees the calculator just standing there, very stock still. He's a detective. I know you like that. Yep. He says, oh, it must be as soon as he moves that everybody stretches. Okay. He stretches him out of shape until he boop, boop, boops it so that everybody goes back to normal. So there's logic there.
And that had to be fun for Ernie Chua to draw.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, oh, I don't have to worry about proportions.
Yeah. We don't get to see him push a special button, but we have to presume that he does. You see him going, boop, 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 and then gets punched into the stack of Golden Age comics and DC Western comics. Yeah. I love that little touch. And then there's a little poster behind Ralph on the last page up on the wall of Superman versus the Amazing Spider-Man. You see that?
Oh, now see, that's the benefit of your book.
Is that not in the digital?
No, it is in the digital. Knowing what it is, I can see what it is.
I see.
Even like blowing that up, I don't think I would have gotten that that's what it is without knowing it. Yeah. From you.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's just like a poster or they taped an actual copy of the Treasury Superman versus Spider-Man up to the wall. Ralph gets the award for the bravest superhero, which is a riot. But Sue, you know, Sue's the best. My husband would like to say, thank you, I deserve it all. Just Sue gets the joke at the end, which is fabulous. And then he's sitting in jail again. He says, now, I think Bob might have figured something out by this point, because he says, the elongated egomaniac never even realized I meant it when I said he'd never catch me again. He's about to find out when I take on my next victim, Green Arrow. So I think Bob has figured out what the end game is here at this point. Yeah. So at this point, he's figured it out. Listeners, you'll have to wait another couple months. Whew. Any final thoughts?
I don't think I have a final thought, but I do have a final question.
Okay.
Paul, what is the calculator's real name?
I don't think we know. Noah, I guess, is why I'm sticking to it. Still don't have his name, so we'll have to tune in next month, listeners, to find out if we learn what the calculator's real name is. We know what he looks like. We know that the police know his name because he's sitting in jail, but we do not know his name. All right, that's it for Catch You Later Calculator this month. Next month, we'll cover 466 and 467, starring Green Arrow and Hawkman, with the first published artwork of Marshall Rogers. But I'm not done. Sean's taking off, but I'm going to jump into my next episode announcement and listener feedback. In March, I'll have as my guest, host of the TV Movie Rewind podcast and frequent commentator on the Fire and Water Network movie, Matt Sirois. Matt and I will be discussing DC Superstars number 13, The Wild and Wacky World of Sergio Aragonés. I'm really excited to do my first humor comic on the show. And of course, we'll have the third installment of Catchulator Calculator with Sean. Look for it on Sunday, March 1st. Now, a little feedback. First, I've got one comment on the Christmas episode that came in after I recorded the feedback to the last episode. John Stibe said, "This was an excellent episode. I'm excited to revisit this classic holiday issue. It truly was special. I'm equally excited for the Monthly Planet announcement. I'm proud to say that I wrote to Ask the Answer Man as a kid, and Bob answered my question. However, I used a silly pseudonym from Schoolhouse Rock. Not kidding. And I'm kicking myself to this day for signing it Rufus Xavier Sass. Perilla. What was I thinking? Great show, like always. Happy holidays, everyone. Thanks, John. I hope you had a great holiday season, too. Now let's get to your comments about our January episode with Peter Watson, where we talked about Wanted, the world's most dangerous supervillains. As always, please leave comments on the show post of or on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. My buddy Dan said he loved the issue. Now, that's something about having some golden age in the mix that makes it special. I like the Calculator story, and I look forward to the next issues, even though I never really understood the Adam's powers. I paused the cast and got the detective book out to quickly read it once I heard Paul and Sean say they were going to cover it. Haven't read the other five Calculator issues yet, but if I had to describe them, I'd say he's basically the mad thinker who fought the Fantastic Four. He was always calculating upcoming events based on his mastery of probabilities, without the calculator glued to his chest. I agree with Sean. His costume is something else. One nit, Paul said that as an aside that the Inventino price increase letter was in response to going from 15 to 20 cents. I think it was from going to 15 to 25 cents and going giant size for a while, and believe it or not, I think I remember reading that letter as a kid, and the move to 25 cents was indeed a big event to little kids. Keep up the great work. Thanks for the heads up on next month's podcast. I will do my calculator homework, but there's a limit. I'm not buying any love comics. Well, Dan, I hope you enjoyed this episode anyway. Next up, we had Hal, who said this was a fun show. I don't really remember this issue, but I must have seen it. I read just about everything back then. I also remember the backup series with the calculator. I remember how it ended. I recall reading the letter columns and how some of the fans were able to predict who the next star would be before it was even announced. It did make sense at the end. Did it though, Hal? Keep listening and see if you agree with us next month when we're done with it. The screen on top of the calculator's head was probably a way to let the readers know what was going on without having the writer to use a lot of text making explanation. All right, I'll take that, Hal. Thanks. Next up, past guest and Fire and Water All-Star Chris Franklin says, "Great show, fellas. I love the art in this era of Superman in the Golden Age. A certain friendly podcaster recently sent me a pair of Alter Ego issues spotlighting the folks who worked as ghosts for Joe Schuster during this period, and it's fascinating stuff. I often forget how nuts some of the Silver Age Flash stories are. I don't think I ever knew that Heatwave Gun was called a hot rod, but it kind of makes sense. So thanks for the enlightenment, Peter. The late Golden, early Silver Age Batman stories really do prove that the 60s TV series may be the most faithful comic adaptation ever, like it or not. Loved the discussion on the first chapter of the Calculated story. I reread these series a few years ago, and yeah, it makes absolutely no logical sense, even within comic book logic, but it's fun, and the art does look nice. When I was a kid, I thought Calculator's suit looked cool. Now he looks like he should be shooting Pez out from the top of his cowl." Thanks, Chris. Ito Boznar says, "Yet again, a great show. I particularly enjoyed Peter's dramatic readings." So then you definitely would enjoy the Earth 2 podcast, Ito, because they do that all the time. On Infantino's art, I'm one of those Bronze Age guys who really didn't like his work on the 70s and after, but very much like everything I've seen from earlier, especially his work on The Flash, Adam Strange, and the various science fiction stories from the 50s and 60s. And yes, his portrayals of women were indeed quite lovely. 100% with you there, Ito. As usual, I enjoyed the creator focus segment. I know a little bit about Wolfolk, and I'm glad you mentioned his book, The Mad Hatter. I read both issues featuring that odd short-lived superhero. They are public domain and available at the Digital Comic Museum and Comic Book Plus. And honestly, they're not bad. Not great, but very interesting and also a bit puzzling in that nowhere is it even explained why the hero even calls himself the Mad Hatter. He doesn't even wear a hat. I'll have to check those out, Ito. Thanks for the tip. Bucky749 is next up. He says, "Here's a question. When was Maxi Zeus created? I was reading DC Showcase Presents Martian Manhunter and the story from Detective Comics number 302, The Crime King of Mount Olympus. The villain could have been a prototype for Maxi Zeus. Cool thought about the prototype, Bucky. Maxi did first appear in Detective number 483, The Curse of Crime Alley, which Sean and I did cover back on Batman Family Reunion. Denny O'Neil was trying hard to make him a thing. He had four appearances over the next 8 issues, but at the end of the day, he only had 8 pre-crisis appearances.
Super Captain's next. He says, great show, Paul and Peter. I never had this book, but it does represent the three top rogues galleries at DC, Batman, Flash, and Superman. This is the Toyman I prefer, even though I probably encounter the Jack B. Nimble version via Super Friends at the same time. Never really worked when they tried to make him edgy and darker, in my opinion. And I had forgotten that there was another villain who had a heroic legacy in the Japanese Toyman, Hiro Okamura, from the early 2000s. A Heatwave sticks out of my mind as having the most memorable origin story of any villain. Getting accidentally locked up in a freezer as a child gave an obsession with heat and warmth, and he always makes one of the best villainous double acts with Captain Cold. Wentworth Miller and Dominic Purcell were particularly good in Flash and Legend of Tomorrow TV series. Yes, I will agree they were terrific, Super Captain. Lastly but not least is the Penguin. Burgess Meredith will always be the definitive version for me, as he is for so many of us who grew up watching him on television. Danny DeVito was also quite good in the movie version. The modern take on him as a mob boss at Swartz headquartered at the Iceberg Lounge works perfectly. Catch You Later Calculator is a nice addition to the show. I remember encountering the calculator at this time. That costume is burned into my memory, but I can't recall anything about the stories in which I saw him. This show is always a good listen. I don't know that I've ever read a romance comic, but I will be here next month for that episode anyway. And I have sampled the Earth 2 podcast, particularly episodes on the Secret Society of Supervillains. Awesome. Glad you enjoyed the Earth 2 podcast, and thanks for your comments, as always, Super Captain. Host of Fade Out and the top dog of the Fire and Water Network, Rob Kelly says, great show. Peter brought some great energy to the guest slot and was a lot of fun. I liked his American guy voice too. With all the various features this show now has, main guest segment, creator bio, calculator with Sean feedback, DC Special Cast is now like a dollar comic with all its various features. That can't be a coincidence. You're absolutely right, Rob. One of the things I love in podcasts, both listening and creating, are multiple little segments. And I got that love from all the special features that these Bronze Age had. Not just dollar comics, you know, all the other ones too, but of course the dollar comics was the best format. Back to Rob. DC got a lot of use out of that wanted poster art template, this comic, the wanted recent print series, and the bonus features of various villain-based treasury editions. I hope whoever drew it, Nick Carty, probably, he got thrown a few $100 for the trouble, but probably not. Oh, by the way, regarding the calculator, why do I think he finally had to install a passcode on his chest after all the other villains in Belle Reve kept typing 80085 on it while he was asleep? Adult as always. Thanks, Rob. Past guest and friend of the network, Martin Gray, says, a new DC special cast. What a treat for a new year. And what a comic. What a guest. Special thanks for that lovely plug of my review of The Wanted Hardback. I hadn't even known about the two special comics that preceded the regular series. Yes, why aren't they in with the rest of the reprinted reprints? I don't know, Martin. Looking at the top right of the cover, by the price tag, I mistook the pins for the Gentleman Ghost's hat and the Fiddler's Fiddle. Actually, wouldn't that have been cool? Do you see it? So, Martin, I did not see it before, but now I cannot unsee it. That is too funny. That's great. That detail in the Batman story in which he says the marble has saved him and Robin many times, that is just bizarre. Was there ever a story called The Many Marvelous Saves of the Batman? Maybe a giant Batman's Greatest Games gimmicks. The Toyman never had a castle outside the story, as I recall, and it's weird that I recall this story at all, as I don't think I had this comic, but I've read everything in it. And the Superman story has only been reprinted here in an omnibus that I definitely don't have. I'm going to have to check the comic cupboard next time I'm at the family home. I love the calculator segment. It's so odd the soul saga has never been collected. I mean, we got the search for Jean Loring, and who cares about her? The only issue of the serial I had before the big conclusion was the Green Arrow story, which was called Take Me Out to the Ball Game, but didn't feature Gene Kelly. So it'll be great to hear you chaps going through and giving us your special brand of commentary. Peter was great, and I hope we get to hear you soon over on the Earth 2 show, Paul. Happy New Year. Thank you, Martin. Lizanne Oswalt says, impressive podcast, most impressive. Sorry, I don't see the Toyman as scary here. He looks like one of my exes. Superman Jack in the Box was fun, though. Flash versus Captain Cold and Heatwave? I can see them in my head, how they were on the WB shows in this. The art is good. The story is, well, a Silver Age story, I'll give it that. Next, the Penguin story is fine. Not my favorite villain. Yep, that's all I got on it. It's Sean and Paul together on another podcast. Cool, The Calculator. But an okay Atom story. You guys are arguing about the physics for something in an Atom story? That man got his power by carrying a dwarf stone home in a truck. All right, I can't argue with that, Lizanne. Thanks for the comments. Next up, future guest. John Stibe says, I thoroughly enjoy the coverage of DC Special number 14 Wanted. I was recently looking through my collection for a different back issue, and it turns out I own this. Sweet. But I really wanted to comment on the first installment of Catch You Later Calculator. This comic was most likely the first Batman solo comic I ever bought at roughly the age of 8 in the summer of 76. I must confess, however, I bought it because it looked to young me like that was Spider-Man on the cover kicking Batman in the face. I love that. Thank you, John. That's a fantastic story. I've always loved the Calculator as a memorable villain from my youth, and I also have been a Ray Adam Palmer fan for as long as I've read comics. I wonder if both of these things are due to the fact that I bought and read and reread this issue many, many times as a fledgling comic book fan. Regardless, I think this is going to be a fun feature. I will enjoy following along with you and Sean as this feature continues, since I don't know if I've ever actually read all of the other parts of it. So thanks for a fun show, as always. Thanks, John, and I look forward to having you on. And finally, let's end with some comments on the Smash Up Derby cars. Brian Schufo over on Blue Sky commented, he said, "My older brothers also had the SSP Smash Up Derby set with those classic T-stick rip cords. By the time I got to play with them, all the doors and hoods and all the other fall-offable parts were long gone." And he included a picture, which was awesome. Thanks, Brian. Back on the website, Matthew Davis said, "I also had a set of those Demolition Derby cars you mentioned. I think they came out around the time Pinky Tuscadero showed up on Happy Days as she and Fonzie competed in a Demolition Derby. How the heck do I remember this stuff?" To which Hal came back, "Yeah, but you don't remember what you had for breakfast yesterday, right, Matthew?" Thanks, guys. Thanks, everybody, for comments. On that note, I'll close down the comments, but I do have one more thing. So last week, as I was recording this on February 21st, it was my turn to create the post for our Patreon supporters. I asked about everybody's reading habits. I asked three questions. One, about how many individual comic issues do you read per week? Two, what's your preferred method? Floppy issues, trades, or hardcovers, or digital? And three, do you read along with comic podcasts? So I'm going to read out an excerpt of everybody who responded to that, and we got some really fun responses. Jeffrey Owens responded he read about half a dozen a week, all in print, and he rarely reads along with podcasts, although he really wants to, but he never seems to get the timing right. Chris Mort said he probably reads about 20 issues a week. "I read when I wake up with my morning coffee, and I read at night right before I go to bed. Then, of course, I read while on the throne." Little too much information there, Chris. He said, "I don't have a preferred method of reading. I'll read floppy sometimes, trades others, although digital is the way I read most often due to convenience. I do follow along with podcasts when I can. For example, he just read the number one of the 1991 JSA series so he could follow along with Shag." He does say it is a fun way to experience the comics. He says, "This network has helped me find my joy. I love comics and everything about them, and I look forward to the deep dives in my favorite hobby." Thanks, Chris. Jeremiah Jones Goldstein said he tries to read about 15 to 20 comics a week. He sets monthly reading goals, and if I meet them, it works out to about 20 a week. "I prefer single issues. Most of the single issues I buy now are more image titles from my favorite creators. I have come around to digital and read almost all my current DC and Marvel through the apps." He also uses Hoopla and Comixology for things that he missed and wants to read but not purchase. "Big omnibuses are his least favorite because they are cumbersome. And I used to read along with comic podcasts, but now that I'm fully remote, I don't have a commute. I don't listen to the podcast as much as I used to." I think that's a common refrain, Jeremiah. Extremely Uncanny said he reads about 8 comics a week, sometimes more, sometimes less. The last few years, he's been keeping a log, and he averaged about 1.2 per day. Not a lot, but when factoring teaching and parenting 3 kids, plus other hobbies like writing comic reviews and art, not too bad. As for preferred format, he prefers digital. He gets all the Marvel stuff in review for Comps for the Beat, plus Unlimited for anything older than the past year or so. He does have the DC Infinite Ultra tier, and that's been amazing. Next up, Kevin Wetter said he reads floppies and trades, has a robust pull list, but I do get some collected stuff. He reads about 20 comics on an average week. "I read along sometimes, but mostly I listen and then say I need to revisit a book that was covered." Scott Rowland reads 70 to 100 per week. "I'm retired and I have a goal of reading 10 a day. At that rate, I have 13 years of comics to get through, presuming I don't buy any more. Ha! Most of my reading is digital, as that is more convenient than digging through my boxes. A large part of my collection is not available digitally, so it is amazing. Mix. I do sometimes read along, but more frequently as a podcast or something I haven't read in a while triggers a desire to go back and read it again, or for the first time. Most podcasts I listen to while exercising or driving, so reading in real time isn't practical." Part of the Fire and Water Network, Ryan Daly said, "I try to read at least one comic a day on average. Sometimes I'll read a whole lot more, and sometimes I'll go stretches without any, but in general I try to read at least one right before I go to bed. Most of my reading is on the Marvel and DC digital platforms, though I get a lot of trades and hardcovers of non-Marvel, non-DC stuff. I don't get to a comic store more than a handful of times a year, but when I do, I make it a point to buy one or two floppies." Matt Saroy says, "I'd average about 12 comics a week. About 80% of that is rereading my old comics and trade collections. My most consistent habit, however, is waiting until I have an entire story arc or miniseries before I start reading it. I'm the same way, Matt. I can't keep track on a month-to-month basis very well at all." The Outcaster Tim Price says, I vary greatly. When I'm extremely busy, it might be 5 to 10 a week, but when I have time or a reading project is in swing, it could be 20 to 30 per week. He gets the occasional floppy issues from his buddy, runs a comic shop. I'm all into digital now for new issues and gobs of old, but new to me series. And yes, he loves reading along with comic podcasts. I don't have the time for as many shows as the last 2 years. See extremely busy comment above, but that continues to be my favorite podcast comment. Mark Balbus reads about 20 comics a week, a mixture of old and new. Preferred method are treasuries, individual printed issues, and physical hardcover omnibuses. I'm starting to warm up to digital comics through Hoopla and DC Infinite, but I won't buy a digital comic. I never read along with comic podcasts. Well, once to a treasure cast, but that was it. Dr. Ange said, I read 5 to 10 comics a week, a mix of old and new, and mostly always floppy. I do read along with comic podcasts when it's a book I know I like or I'm interested in, but I listen to a lot of podcasts, so sometimes it's the podcast that leads me to seek out a comic for the first time. Ian Fletcher said, I go through fits and spurts. For a few weeks, I might read a dozen comics a week, and then go through several weeks without reading any at all. I love comic books, but I have at least two other time-intensive hobbies, and I like to get into novels. I prefer reading plot arcs in a sitting if possible. In terms of preferences, I do prefer floppy issues primarily, but for back issues, I'm going to go to trades. I was reading a lot of digital comics, but I find I relish them a lot less when I read them digitally. There's something about a temptation to rush through the issue. I like to listen to comic podcasts about a comic I've never read, and then read it for myself, and then go back and re-listen to the podcast. The only exception is Who's Who or Oh Hot Moo or not if I have the issues. And then my hero, Chuck Dill, says, I've been waiting for someone to ask me about my comic reading. Most people tune out when I talk about it, but stay with us, listeners. I keep spreadsheets and I create pivot tables to track my yearly reading. Not joking, I'm a spreadsheet guy. I love the way this is going. In 2025, I read 3,428 comics. 250 of those were published between 1940 and 41. 1,404 were published between 59 and 63. And 408 of those were published between 1987 and 1990. 1,749 were published in 2025. So that averages about 65 comics a week. I always read digitally. It's much more manageable for my style of reading. I have 5 different reading streams that I work on daily. One comic from the 1990 stream, about to roll over to 91. One comic from my 1940s stream, currently in 1941. One comic in my incremental stream, a one-a-day catch-up of more recent series I missed out on. 4 comics a day from modern comics, keeping up with the latest. And as many as I can from my primary reading stream, which is all DC and Marvel, some Gold Key and Archie superheroes. I'm currently in 1963. I don't read along with comic podcasts because most of the issues covers are already slated for one of my reading streams. Wow, Chuck, that's fantastic. Thank you for sharing all that. I love it. For myself, just to let you guys know, I generally read about 8 to 10 comics a day on average. That works about 60 to 70 a week as well. Plus, I probably read a prose novel a week, usually something light like Star Trek novel or a Jack Reacher or something like that. In terms of format, I use all 3 methods. I love those thick trades, especially DC Finest, Epic Collections, but I do read a lot digitally as well. I also do like the omnibuses, mainly for older material. Golden Age is great, but you can't beat reading on your iPad for convenience. The only format I really just can't read due to my eyes anymore are the tiny font or digest. Sorry, Sean. And as far as new comics go, a couple years ago, I finally stopped buying floppies new after 50 plus years. That was really hard, but I do keep up on a lot of series in DC UI, but I have taken to pulling out a lot of Bronze Age floppy issues this past year. I was inspired after reading the Bronze Age Superman DC Finest Kryptonite Nevermore last summer. Since I have all the issues, I then pulled and read every Superman and Action Comics from 1970 through the crisis. It was about 400 issues and took me just under 6 months, and I had a great time doing it. This year, I've started working on the Bronze Age Flash and Wonder Woman. We can get through them, hopefully, in about 6 months as well. As you probably know, I love vintage ads and letters pages. And, you know, just part of the experience you don't get with digital or trades or omnibuses or anything else. And so reading those Bronze Age really brings back great memories for me. And finally, I do try to read along with other comic podcasts when I can. Ones I try to read along with every month are Nightcast, The Fantastic Poor, Peacebound and Down, and the Earth 2 podcast. But I can't always make that happen, especially if I'm prepping for one of my episodes at that very time. Thank you for all of our Patreon supporters who participated in that little survey. That was fun and enlightening, and I will definitely do it again in the future. If anybody else wants to get in on the fun, reminder that if you are enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray our costs. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. This episode's special thanks go out to our Sunday supporters, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, and Mike Atchison. To find out more, go to patreon.com/FWPodcasts and thanks. That'll do it for the feedback section and for this episode. Special thanks to Siskoid for appearing on this episode. I really enjoyed Love 1971. And thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me and Movie Matt Sorois next month as we enter the wild and wacky world of Sergio Aragonés.